Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what can nature teach us about how to build better societies? Then, how has music shaped politics historically, and how is it changing politics today? What can nature teach us about organizing our societies, governments, and businesses? Our next guest says a lot. The creatures in nature, he says, have been living and thriving in a risk-filled planet for billions of years and have survived some of the deadliest conditions by constantly adapting to the challenges, by decentralizing their responses, by cooperating with unlikely partners, and changing as a result. Rafe Sagran is a marine ecologist and environmental policy analyst, as well as a research scientist at the Institute of the Environment at the University of Arizona. He's also author of Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. It's great to have you with us, Rafe Sagran. Let's start with your fundamental premise, which seems to be that nature really has a lot of important lessons for us, no matter what kinds of things we're organizing in society.
Any situation where there's uncertainty and some kind of risk in the environment, which we all deal with, are areas where we can learn from natural evolution and adaptation, because that's what natural organisms are dealing with, 3.5 billion years of total uncertainty in a risk-filled world. So it can be national security, but it can also be how you're going to get your business through the next economic cycle, or how you're dealing with a group of at-risk kids in a classroom. It's really any time you have a situation that has a high degree of uncertainty.
Your prologue was so interesting, where you talk about the late December 2006 when the animals started to act really funny and they started running to higher ground and refusing to walk on the beach.
Yeah.
And then an hour later, we had that awful tsunami that killed 225,000 people. And you point out that the animal-based system worked where our man-made tsunami warning system failed.
Exactly. So animals basically are much better alarm systems than anything humans created. You just had an article that I commented on in the LA Times a couple days ago on the BioWatch alarm systems, which are billion-dollar alarm systems that are totally failing everywhere, giving lots of false alarms and creating all this uncertainty. But animal systems work because they have such an intensive observational sense of the world and how it changes and how it usually changes, and then they can pick up on these subtle changes far earlier than most humans.
Is this primarily keener senses? You've talked about observation and keen observation being really important.
Yeah.
But animals, of course, do have these keener senses. What is the explanation?
Well, in some cases, it's having keener senses. Some of them may have a magnetic sense, and they may have keener chemical senses, but it's also just the practice of observing makes you a better observer, and that's what my newer book, Observation and Ecology, which comes out this week, is about. It's about how the practice of continually observing complex systems like the natural world makes you a better observer and allows you essentially a predictive capacity. Although organisms don't really predict the future, you can essentially get a sense of what fits into a pattern and what doesn't fit into a pattern, and that allows you to exploit new opportunities. And you can see this in human athletes as well. The best human athletes, not coincidentally, also happen to be the ones that practice the most. So you would think, you know, someone like Michael Jordan or Wayne Gretzky would be done with practice because they're so good. Well, they're the ones who practice the longest, the hardest, and what they're doing is essentially training their brain to make predictions based on patterns.
This would go into the chapter you talk about learning and the different kinds of learning, and learning you call a force of nature, almost like gravity.
It is. It's impossible to be in the world and be observing the world, especially the way that wild organisms do, and not learn. And that's the real danger of spending so much time inside, spending so much time in front of our screens, is that we're learning in a much less complex world. There's just no way about it. A binary system like a computer is much less complex than a natural system, and you're essentially dulling down the learning process, which is why I talk a little bit in Learning from the Octopus and a lot in the book Observation and Ecology about how we've got to get our kids back out into nature and put the screens down and push them out there and let them solve their own problems out there.
Let's talk about some of these kinds of learning. One is this kind of interaction with the environment. One might be, you said, even encoded in DNA passed from, you use the mother sea otter to pup, and the kind of combined learning that is important and how that manifests in nature versus what we deal with as humans.
Yeah, exactly. So you get learning essentially just from passing down your genes. It's essentially intergenerational learning, and then you learn during your lifetime. Now, in both cases, in nature, I say that the most important learning, the learning that really gets you somewhere, is learning from your past successes. So every single organism in nature is an example genetically of learning from its ancestors' successes. But they also have to learn from their successes what things work, what tactics work, what behaviors worked, and replicate those during their lifetimes. We tend to do a lot of focus in society on learning from failure. So we focus intently on what we did wrong. We have all sorts of after-action reports and meetings in our business about everything we did wrong. And there's a lot in the business literature these days that suggests it's sort of clever to learn from your mistakes or learn from failures. And it sounds sort of self-effacing. But in fact, learning from failure in nature is a dead end. It means you die. It means you don't reproduce. Learning from success is the process of building on something that works and then building something even better off of that platform. And the example I give in the book, Hurricane Katrina, sure, there were a lot of failures that we wanted to learn from and not repeat. And I certainly don't say that we should ignore them. But in all the after-action report on Hurricane Katrina, which identified over 100 different failures, they didn't talk at all about the most important success, which was a Coast Guard containing 9 million gallons of oil spilled. And it turns out that that one success is exactly the one thing you needed to learn from for the next big Gulf disaster, which was the Deepwater Horizon. So by being so focused on the failures and having no focus on the successes, government missed a really good opportunity to learn from what it takes to clean up, in this case, oil in a logistically compromised situation.
One thing I was wondering as you were talking about and writing about learning from the ancestors is people who have gone through really traumatic things, say Holocaust survivors, genocide survivors, war survivors, do you think that their offspring learn something that is not necessarily adaptive to a society that's not at war?
No, I don't think so. I think that when you're surviving in completely novel, horrific situations, that's when your natural adaptive capacities really kick in. And by telling those stories, how did I survive this war? How did I survive through the Holocaust? You essentially provide a way for your offspring or people in your community to learn from those successes. That's why I give several stories of young officers and soldiers who have been fighting for 10 years now in Iraq and Afghanistan. These people are coming back. They have been incredibly adaptable in how they survived over there. And there's two things that we really need to focus on with this population. One is ensuring that they're healthy and that they're getting through the stress and physical abilities that they have. But the second is that everyone, if they own a business, if they're in government, if they're in a nonprofit, should be snapping up these young men and women because they are the brain trust of how to be adaptable in the world. They have incredible ideas and they have it sort of built into their system now of how to be adaptable. And they can use those skills in peacetime. They can use them in civilian jobs. So I say, you know, it's not just a patriotic duty to hire a veteran. It's really going to benefit your organization to bring these people in.
I'm going to want to go back to that whole idea of adaptability, since that's one of the big focuses of your book. But before I do, I want to stick to the learning thing for a moment. There's also an idea among teachers about unlearning things that are bad, unlearning a bad habit, unlearning a mistake. Where does that come in? Because if you practice a bad behavior or a bad mistake, it just becomes part of your learning process.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just back east visiting my parents and driving up Route 8 in Connecticut, and I was brought back to my childhood where every time we drove up this complicated intersection on Route 8. My mom would take the wrong exit, and she would say, I know it's the wrong exit every time I do it. And she just had it built into her brain to go off on the wrong lane. So I've been thinking about that. And certainly, you can reinstill learning of bad habits, which is why you have to go back to this process of being keenly aware of your environment, because it's your environment and the changes that in your environment that sort of dictate what's going to work and what's not going to work there. So that's a way you sort of break out of that cycle.
So let's talk about some of these creatures that you look at, like the title of your book, Learning from the Octopus, that perhaps we can take guidance from the living world about how society can actually function and function well. One of the major issues is adaptability. And you talk about the octopus as a very important creature to watch and how it adapts. Give us some examples.
Yeah, the octopus is a great metaphor for how we can use adaptability, because the octopus demonstrates so many of the characters of adaptable systems as a whole. And surprisingly, the octopus is not that much different from us in the sense that it has a very good central brain or central controller. It has a cognitive mind, really, and a lot of people don't know that. But octopuses are smart, clever. They can create things. They can make and use tools. They think about the future. And yet, the octopus doesn't use that wonderful central brain when it really needs to adapt quickly. For example, if it needs to change color quickly, it doesn't have its brain yell to arm one turn purple, and then arm two turn green, and arm three turn kind of purplish blue. Rather, it has millions of individual skin cells spread all along its body that each individually respond to the changes that those skin cells perceive in the environment. And that as a whole, collectively, gives the octopus its camouflage. So the octopus has a brain which it can use, but it also shuts down that brain almost, or lets go of that central control in order for all those localized agents, all those individual skin cells, to respond and adapt to the environment. And that's a key metaphor, because a lot of the adaptable solutions I talk about require letting go of some of that central control, stopping the process of giving orders and switching to a process of issuing challenges where you say, here's a problem we're facing. Anyone go out and solve this problem. And that activates all these individuals who can collectively come up with solutions that help us adapt. And you can do that kind of octopus-like camouflage or octopus-like problem solving in any kind of organization.
So it is an argument for decentralization.
It is. I suggest that it's, like I say, have an open mind, but not so open your brain falls out.
Right.
There's also a role for the central controller, but it may be different than what the role is right now that we see in a lot of organizations and a lot of businesses and a lot of governments.
I learned so much about the octopus from reading your book and really wanted to hear you describe a little bit of the activities that it takes on. You mentioned that the tool building before, but there are all these other things about the ink that it can spray out, and then how it still can change one side of itself to attract a mate while changing the other side to warn others off.
Yeah, and this is another key theme that makes the octopus a great central metaphor, is it does so many different things to solve problems. And I talk about this as a process of creative redundancy that's also very common in nature. We tend to think of redundancy as wasteful or inefficient, but in fact, redundancy gives you multiple different ways of solving problems because, once again, you can't really predict what the next problem is going to be. So an octopus can jet away in a cloud of ink. It can camouflage itself. It can bite an enemy. It can squeeze itself into a tiny, tiny crevice. Once, years ago, my old advisor, Chuck Baxter, when he got married in Monterey Bay, threw a wine bottle, a champagne bottle, over the boat that he got married on. And about 5 years later, he was diving and saw the same wine bottle with an octopus stuffed inside. So an octopus can squeeze itself through the neck of a wine bottle, which is quite amazing.
Could it get out?
Oh, yeah, sure. So it's incredibly flexible, and it has this great brain that I mentioned. So the octopus has been shown to utilize new things in its environments. There's an octopus video that shows an octopus has learned to take the halves of coconuts that tourists throw overboard in a South Pacific island, and it grabs them, takes them back to its lair, and later can use those two halves of a coconut and wrap itself up in them and use it as a kind of suit of armor.
So this was one of the examples of adaptability, which is what you argue we're missing in some of our human bureaucratic states.
We see it especially in businesses now. There's this endless pursuit of efficiency, and we think by getting rid of redundancy, often in the form of firing people, that we're going to become more efficient. But that misses the larger picture. We become less adaptable as we become less redundant in this way. I know a businessman who's very successful. He runs a manufacturing business, and he bases his whole business on biological principles. And one of the things he was proudest to show me was an entire warehouse he had of spare parts. And he said, none of my competitors would ever waste a whole warehouse on spare parts. They're all about just-in-time manufacturing, very efficient. And yet, when any one of my clients needs one of these parts, I'm the only one who has them. So I can charge anything for them, and I can, you know, mark up whatever I want, and then customers come back to me because they know I'm the only one who has what they need. So he's looking at the much bigger picture, even though it's inefficient to house all those spare parts.
The other, I thought, really key point in your book that you draw from nature again is the idea of symbiosis and cooperation. You said that it appears in nature even in the most unlikely situations. What are some of those?
The amazing thing about symbiosis is indeed that sometimes organisms that you think would have nothing to do with one another develop these partnerships. And there are examples everywhere in nature. For example, cleaner wrasses are small fish that clean the teeth of much larger predatory fish. And what's amazing that we're just learning now is that these symbiotic partnerships often have what we call emergent properties, or things that you wouldn't expect from the relationship of the two organisms. So we're learning now that these larger predatory fish are much less aggressive to all the fish in that reef patch when they're being cleaned by these cleaner wrasses. And we see that the most effective symbiotic partnerships in humans often come, again, between groups of humans or individuals that you would never expect to work together. And I talk in the book about a partnership of Israeli, Palestinian, and Jordanian health practitioners who are all working together to solve the problem of infectious diseases, no matter what side of whatever disputed territories they arise in. Now, one of the important things about this partnership is, and I talk about how natural systems do not aim for perfection. They just try to solve problems. These partnerships between the Israelis, Palestinians, and Jordanians are not trying to create peace in the Middle East. That is not their goal. They don't put that forward as their goal. They're trying to solve the immediate problem of infectious diseases. And by focusing intently on that immediate problem, they've created a very strong partnership. Now, that partnership may result in the first steps towards peace in the Middle East, but they don't put that as a goal, just like natural organisms and natural systems do not have goals. They do not have a plan, a long-term plan. They're just trying to solve the challenges in the environment. So when you want to create a symbiotic partnership, first of all, it doesn't matter who you want to create it with. You could create it with anyone. But secondly, you want to look at what is the problem we can solve by working together, not, oh, it'd be a great idea for us to work together.
There were other aspects, too, like the evolution of some of these symbiotic relationships. They transform from one to another. You said some viruses start out parasitic, later become harmless.
Absolutely. That's another thing we're learning about symbiotic partnerships is that they can transform. And many symbiotic partnerships that are around today used to be conflictual relationships between organisms or competitive relationships.
And the other aspect I thought was really interesting and important in this is that things are always changing. The symbiosis is always changing. The environment is always changing. And that nothing is really going to stay the same.
all the good naturalists going back to Darwin recognize that change is another sort of force of nature, something that you just can't deny, that the world is always changing. And that's exactly at the core of why anyone needs to be adaptable, because whatever you do now may not be what you need to do to solve the problems of the future. And the problems of today may be totally different than the problems of tomorrow. And the only way to deal with that, because you can't predict every possible change that could occur in a complex world, the only way to deal with it is to become adaptable.
Now, you noted that one researcher, when he was looking at these kinds of relationships, he saw them decidedly pointing away from conflict and warfare.
This is an early naturalist and ecologist, people like Warder Ali, who was at the University of Chicago, and then his student, Ed Ricketts, who is pretty well known to people on the West Coast. He was a good friend of John Steinbeck's, and he appears in a number of Steinbeck's novels. These early naturalists really didn't see any difference between the natural world and human societies, and they thought that lessons could easily be transposed across from the natural world to society. And some of them were working in the period between wars, and they were trying to figure out what can we learn from nature about conflict and about getting rid of conflict. And one of the things, especially, that Ali was focused on was cooperation among organisms. And he felt that the natural tendency, not necessarily within an organism's lifetime, but through generations, the natural tendency was towards cooperation, that even relationships that were conflictual now would evolve into cooperative relationships, and that it was a continual cycle, that they would go back, there would be new conflicts that would arise, and those too would also ultimately transform into cooperative relationships. So it wasn't a one-way pathway by any means, it was a cycle. But it was a cycle that where cooperation continually trumped conflict.
Of course, you're a scientist, but you also worked in Congress. Did you talk about any of these things when you were in Congress, when you were working
there? No, it was actually my own adaptation and my own movement. I say that adaptation is about leaving or being forced from your comfort zone, and that happened to me. My comfort zone was always working in the tide pools of the Pacific Coast, but I found myself after 9/11 way outside of my comfort zone working as a science advisor to Congresswoman Hilda Solis, who's now the Labor Secretary in Washington, D.C. And it was my observations, essentially being a naturalist of the world of Washington, D.C., since I didn't have tide pools to look at, those observations led me to think about a better way to do security, because what I was seeing was security going up everywhere. I stole Mike Davis's title from his book about L.A., An Ecology of Fear, to describe Washington, D.C. after 9/11. It was an ecology of fear. There were new signs of security everywhere, but they always stayed the same. So new metal detectors everywhere, but the procedures never changed. And we learned very quickly, we adapted very quickly as staffers on the Hill to figure out how you get around these metal detectors so you didn't have to take your keys out of your pocket, things like that. And I thought, if staffers, to avoid a little inconvenience, can figure out how to get through these security systems, an adaptable organism like a terrorist certainly could figure that out. So that led me to start thinking about these things and thinking about all the ways that organisms adapt to deal with a changing environment.
And then two contentions I had with the argument, kind of challenges, not really contentions, I should say. One is, you suggest essentially that bureaucracies are not really changing. But I would argue that they are changing, even if they change slowly.
Certainly. I mean, everything changes, and bureaucracies can change. What I'm suggesting is not that we have to completely eliminate these bureaucracies, get rid of the Department of Homeland Security, and start over again. It's nice when you can create an adaptable system out of nothing, like Google was created as an adaptable company. But I show through examples of even some very traditional companies like 3M and very traditional bureaucracies like the Department of Defense that there are people working within those organizations and figuring out ways to be adaptable. So you can start creating adaptable systems anywhere. You don't have to take the whole thing down and rebuild it. Again, nature doesn't aim for or try to be perfect. You just have to solve the problems. And the way you do it is by starting to issue these challenges in any part of an organization. And I show how 3M, for example, did that brilliantly when they wanted to reduce their environmental footprint. They didn't have the CEO say, everyone recycle 20% more as an order. They issued a challenge and said, anyone in this organization who can help us reduce our environmental footprint, give us your ideas. And they had over 8,000 different successful ideas that were implemented that massively reduced their environmental footprint, saved the company millions and millions of dollars, and didn't cost the company anything. All people got for participating in this challenge was like a certificate of achievement. The remarkable thing about issuing challenges is that people will rise to the occasion. They are empowered and excited to help solve a problem, and it takes very little motivation, financially or otherwise. A little bit, but it always turns out to be much less than you would expect. And it always turns out to be much cheaper, and you get results much more quickly than the order-based mentality where an expert or a small group of experts tells everyone else what to do and expects them to follow it.
And then finally, as I was reading the book and I sat it down to just sort of think about it, I thought, well, there's so much that you are right about in terms of there's so much in the natural environment and the adaptability and things that we have sort of lost. And then at the same time, I thought human beings are the ones that are surviving the most of all the other creatures.
And we are an incredibly adaptable species. And in some ways, that has gotten us 99.9% of the way, but we're starting to see where all that adaptability that allowed us essentially to insulate ourselves from the daily struggle to survive, and I always put a caveat that there's still a billion people in this world who don't get enough to eat every day, which means that they are still in the tooth and claw world of surviving every day. But for the rest of us, we've insulated ourselves to some extent from the daily pressures, and that sort of dulled our adaptive senses, just as I talk about spending so much time in front of our screens and indoors is dulling our observational senses, which allow us to be adaptable. And so the book is really a call to get back a little bit of that adaptability that we used to have. And again, we see it where modern humans are put in situations of heavy stress, where they have to be adaptable, like the soldiers and Marines who have spent 10 years fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan have become very adaptable again.
So that old saying of if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger might be true.
It may be, yeah.
Well, great. Thank you so much for being with us. The book, again, is called Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. And we've been speaking with Rafe Sagarin. Thank you so much, Rafe.
Thank you.
When we come back, how has music shaped politics historically, and how is it changing politics today? Stay tuned.
The drumfish, they beach themselves in Harukari. The blackbirds, they fell in thousands from the sky.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. All over the world and throughout history, music has been a vital part of affecting social and political change. At times, the powers that be resist that change by oppressing music and the arts. How has music shaped politics historically, and how is it changing politics today? We're joined by three experts. Josh Kuhn is professor of communication and journalism and also the director of the Popular Music Project at USC Annenberg's Norman Lear Center. He's also author of Audiotopia, Music, Race, and America, and co-editor of the book series Refiguring American Music. Mark Levine is with us. He is professor of Middle Eastern History at University of California, Irvine. His books include Why They Don't Hate Us, Lifting the Veil on the Axis of Evil, and Heavy Metal Islam, Rock, Resistance, and the Story of Islam's Generation X. Richard Flax is Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He is the author of Making History, The American Left and the American Mind, and Playing for Change, Music and Musicians in the Service of Social Movements. Dick Flax, I'm going to start with you to put this into a historic and political context with Woody Guthrie and also his fellow cohort of artists and how they have helped to shape American politics as we have it today.
Well, I would say more specifically, helped to shape American dissent or protest politics, social movements. That was the goal that Woody Guthrie and his colleagues, if you want to call them that, in the early years of the 1940s, late 1930s, set out to do. They had a project, which I think Woody, among others, described as taking traditional music rather than the popular mainstream music of the day and putting lyrics to that music that would deal with contemporary issues, and particularly in their day, the labor movement. And I think when you learn about them, then you can possibly think back for decades, back to the 19th century, the labor movement in this country as well as other places always had a strong musical dimension to it. And Woody and his people like Pete Seeger and others picked up that thread and tried to revitalize that at the time that I'm referring to. I think, though, that the main impact of that project politically really was in the 60s by what's been called the children and grandchildren of Woody Guthrie, Dylan most famously, who introduced this form of musical expression just when the mass movements of the 60s were emerging and helped to shape particularly the student movement, the youth revolt, the anti-war movement of the 60s through the songs that provide a shared identity, I think, for what ended up being millions of people, really.
So we have a shared identity. And then, Josh Kuhn, maybe this is the perfect place to bring you in, because you've looked at U.S. musical history as being intertwined with the history of race and ethnicity and identity. How do you see this interacting?
Well, I think that if you go back and you even just start with the very kind of foundations of the notion of America itself, the very kind of mythical promise of a democratic America, we see that song and music have long been central to debates around that. And the most obvious place to look there, of course, is in the music of slaves and in the sorrow songs of newly arrived Africans and African Americans in the United States, where music might not have sounded political, might not have announced itself as a protest song in the way that we just heard in the 1960s, it really took shape in that way. But in the early days, of course, when we're talking about sorrow songs and slave songs, you're talking about music that had codes, music that didn't announce itself as overtly protest or oppositional, but served a political function. And I think throughout the history of the very notion of America, the history of the United States itself, music has always been a site for struggle around the meanings of freedom and liberty. And that's still the case to this very day.
Mark Levine, you've argued in your work that music is a better way of understanding culture and societies, particularly in the Middle East, than are many other means. Why do you say that?
Well, there's several reasons. First of all, music is one of the oldest and most profound cultural expressions, and so many other aspects of culture come through it. So, for example, prayer and religious performance is very often traditionally expressed musically. Certainly in the Middle East, there's a very old tradition of protest poetry and then music. You know, going back at least into the 30s, 40s, 50s, you see this naturally in the protests, whether in Tahrir Square in Cairo or when I was there, and so much music just naturally exploding from there. or in Tunisia, or in Syria, where at least one of the major poet singers there was brutally murdered. And in Morocco, another one is in jail, you know, on potentially trumped up politicized charges, a rapper. It's also a way of seeing commonalities. I think so much of the problem when Americans look at other cultures, especially the Middle East, where we have so many conflicts and so many misunderstandings, music is a way of seeing the commonalities between the struggles everyone shares. And I think when you see the, you know, really strong influence, let's say, the early 2010-11 revolts had on the Occupy movement in Europe and the U.S., you can see how, especially through music and through poetry and through this artistic expression, they were able to create solidarities between movements in different countries that otherwise would have been much harder to have.
You bring up another important point, which is the oppression of the arts as a means of maybe oppressing a certain kind of communication or a solidarity. Tell us a little bit about this oppression that you've seen.
I don't want to overemphasize, as some people have done, but one of the causal factors in the explosion of protests in Tunisia was the jailing of this one rapper, El General, who wrote a song called Rais Le Bled, President of the Country, where he was, you know, really just begging the president at that point, Ben Ali, to just understand the cost of his policies and his avarice and greed and violence on a generation. And when he was arrested, young people came out in even bigger numbers to protest his jailing. And that was the first symbol that you can use a music that is specifically related to the generation that's revolting as a means of communicating. You know, Chuck D, Public Enemy, famously said that hip-hop was the CNN of the street of Black America, essentially. And this is exactly what this music became in the Middle East, whether it was hip-hop or for 2 decades before that, music like heavy metal and other so-called Western genres, hardcore punk, were used by young people to express their anger and frustration at a system from which they were severely marginalized. And this has continued. If you look at Egypt, the quote-unquote singer of the revolution, Rami Assam, was grabbed off the street and severely tortured by the Egyptian authorities in the wake of the Egyptian revolution when they next had protests, I think, March of 2011. And just all across the board, wherever there's been these revolts in the Arab world of the last 2 years, musicians and also other types of artists have been at the forefront, and governments have gone after them because of that, because they understand that they're able to communicate in a means that the governments can't compete with. And they can reach people, especially with the internet, but also through live performances and bringing people together in a way that governments can't do. And I'll just give you one example from the last time I was in Egypt with Rami Assam. And he was performing at a major, major protest, tens of thousands of people in Tahrir Square. And there was all this conflict between the Salafis, or the ultra-religious, and the secular forces. And when he came on the stage, he brought with him a huge number of these ultra-soccer fans who had been so crucial to the revolution, at least on the streets and the fighting. And they barreled through all the Salafis to establish a presence there. But once he started playing, you could see Salafis coming and sort of drifting over and listening to the music and nodding their head to his songs, because his songs ultimately were about freedom and against the government and reflected exactly what they were feeling. So even though from an orthodox religious perspective they maybe should not have been listening to it, they couldn't help but listen to it. And for that moment at least, the Salafis and the ultras suddenly understood, and they were in the same space and seeing they had a common enemy, which was the government and the military. And that's precisely the kind of thing that music can do that almost no other art form can do.
Josh Kuhn, talk about what you've seen in Mexico.
In Mexico, in some ways similar to the things that Mark was describing in the Middle East, during the election year, the growing student movement, Yo Soy 132, the Yo Soy 132 student movement, was a movement that actually, when it started, didn't have much music at its core, but gradually music became a central part of how students were organizing themselves and not only expressing their political views in opposition to the right-wing political parties in Mexico, but how they were actually using music as a way to figure out community, as a way to figure out what their ideas were. So I guess what I find really interesting is both how music can be a direct form of expression, as Mark was talking about it, but also can be the very kind of ground for the building of a community that allows that expression to happen. in Mexico, we've been seeing that all over the place, when music has been in marches, but also been a way for students to just have an excuse to get together, to write songs together, to formulate and rehearse ideas that then enter into a larger kind of public debate.
I can recall a time in Chile post-coup that the particular kind of music was banned, and yet people would sneak it on the air on the sly. But soft oppression that we've had here in the U.S. during the McCarthy era and even post-9/11, Dick Flax, could you speak to that?
Well, we do have some great stories of the martyrdom of troubadours in this country. One example before the time you're mentioning was Joe Hill, who was the sort of supreme songwriter of the industrial workers of the world, the wobbly revolutionary labor movement in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. He was tried and executed for murder in Salt Lake City, Utah in 1915, a funeral with 100,000 people in Chicago after his execution. The big McCarthy moment people remember in terms of music was Pete Seeger. He was called before the Un-American Activities Committee. He was one of many entertainers, of course, who experienced that, but Pete took the stance that he would not respond to their questions because the government had no right to ask the questions. And that led to a contempt citation by Congress. He faced a year in jail, but he ultimately won his court case. But that certainly added to the definition of him as a figure of protest and a symbol of strong dissent during that particular period. I'm not sure that repression is the main story in the United States about the uses of music, but I think what we've heard already is that any time you have this kind of musical development, and particularly the emergence of sort of troubadours with a kind of heroic quality to them, they often become targets for the regime, and that move on the part of the regime that's feeling itself threatened can backfire badly. The big moment of supreme repression of music was the torture and execution of Victor Jara, the great troubadour of the Chilean protest in the early 70s. His death really has stayed as a kind of symbol for decades after that, globally, of the power of song, I guess, and of almost a Christ-like figure that emerges from music in many, many parts of the world. It's quite amazing how troubadours can take on that symbolic value for large numbers of people. And the effort to suppress them, as has been said, is very dangerous because it's in the mass popular consciousness and a shared feeling that this music has reached. So when you start to repress it, people who might otherwise not be sure of their politics begin to see this as the true nature of the regime, the repression.
Josh Kuhn, you have looked at Gil Scott-Heron saying music being a melodic form of guerrilla warfare.
This is in the context of a kind of larger examination of the role of music in the Black Power movement. And what's interesting about that quote from Scott-Heron is he both was talking about songs that lyrically were staging a protest, but also just the way that, let's say, in an instrumental piece, I believe the original context for that was that when he was a young boy in music school, the idea that he would play classical music on a piano when his teacher wasn't in the room and make changes to the pieces that he was playing, that was his own form of protest. And so I think it's equally important, as Mark was signaling a bit earlier, that, you know, lyrics clearly are what we so often focus on, with good reason, but also in instrumental songs, just the choice of style, Western pieces versus Eastern pieces, songs that sound, quote-unquote, too Black, too Mexican, too Jewish, songs that disrupt the kind of dominant sonic racial order. Throughout time, just the sound of something can be disruptive enough to cause protest, to cause debate, to cause change. And so I think part of what he was getting at there is that the choices that we make as listeners, the choices that we make as musicians, the music we choose to play and how we choose to play it are aesthetic choices that have social impact.
Mark Levine, let's bring you in on that. Is that what you're seeing also in these changing areas in the Middle East?
I think certainly the music is helping to break down boundaries, absolutely. I guess we could also think of Fela Kuti, who said music is the weapon of the future. I think his last album was named that, and he was someone who knew a lot about regime oppression. They literally threw his mother out the window of his house and killed her because of his political activities. If people look at this organization, Free Muse, a Danish organization that It's basically the Amnesty International for musicians. It's amazing how many musicians around the world right now are suffering severely, whether censored, repression, torture, jail, or murdered, or assassinated for their activities and their music. What I think is clear is that music on its own can't do it, but it's very hard to spread revolution without a cultural marker that can grab people together. You know, music is not a sufficient condition. You know, you can have revolutionary music and not have the revolution. But it's hard to think of revolutions that didn't have some kind of musical component that wasn't just expressing what was already there, but expressing it in a way that amplified it. And I think great music does two things. It amplifies, so it takes what everyone is saying and it boils it down to the most powerful elements and then sends it out even louder. But it also is a kind of prism. It also refracts and breaks apart dominant ideologies and makes it easier to critique or to take what you already, you know, to use, let's say, the idea of Gramsci about common sense versus good sense. Great revolutionary music would take everyone's common sense and turn it into good sense, and that what everyone sort of knows will become something that they can trust their ears. Now, they can trust that what they're suspecting is true, but they can also act on it, and it gives you, you know, both hope and possibility. At least in the music I've been following in the Arab world the last 2 years, that's really what makes it so special. And I think when you look at Woody Guthrie, of course, or any of the great protest movement, Pete Seeger, or for that matter, Public Enemy, or even after 9/11, I think at one point there were over 100 hip-hop songs that have been written in protest against the post-9/11 militarization of American politics that, unless you were listening to KPFK or something, you probably didn't hear. But the artists were out there, and there were these sub-communities, and they were being heard. In all these places, there's still pockets where music is at the forefront and is carrying the torch, so to speak, to keep things lit. And again, I don't want to say that music is more powerful than, let's say, a play or a poem or a piece of graffiti, but out of all those, it's the only one that you can join in on, right? You can read a poem, but you're not going to join, but that's not a communal experience. You can go see a piece of graffiti. You can go see a play. You can watch a movie. You can read a book. But music's the only one where you can gather around with everyone and all do the art together. And that's what I think makes it a uniquely powerful medium for protesting and then transcending.
Dick Flax, let me add to that, because I think that's a very important point. There is something unique about singing as an art form, and I think you put your finger on a good part of it, the idea of gathering around. And as Seeger has tried to show, singing together is a very empowering experience. All religions know that, of course. National anthems sung together, but social movements. What I wanted to add was that it's a unique art form because you don't need an artist in a specialized sense to create or reproduce the song. The song becomes everybody's property. You can sing the song yourself without any talent or trained capacity as a musician. You keep it in your consciousness. It's part of your being in a way that I don't think there's any other art form that can quite do this. Yip Harburg, who was a great political Broadway lyricist, he said a song is the unique way in which thought and feeling are fused, which I think is another part of trying to define why this is a particularly important political means of expression. So it's the bringing together of people. It's the creation of some sense of empowerment when people are singing together. It's the combination of ideas and emotion in a fused way. And there are many different functions of particular songs. Some are these collective empowerments. Some are songs that have ideas that you, the creator of the song, are trying to convey to others. And there's therefore very complicated songs as well as very chant-like songs. One of the great protest songs was Give Peace a Chance by John Lennon. Great because everyone could sing it in mass rallies at the end of the war. Protest movement, millions of people were singing this together. So it was a brilliant invention by Lennon of the most simple idea of how a song can work for empowerment purposes.
This is Josh Kuhn. I think the idea of music as a mode of public gathering and of bringing people together to sing together, to join voices, to raise voices in unison is obviously a very, very important point. And I just want to add to that, though, is that there's also the other aspect, which is the non-public part of music, which is to say the power of being able to listen to a recording in private, in your bedroom, on headphones, actually outside of the public gaze, so that you can retreat to a kind of sense of private refuge to use music as a way to imagine worlds that you didn't think were actually possible or worlds that were being actively being shut down in front of your very eyes and ears. So that, for me, part of what makes music so singularly special, I think, in many ways as a political tool is how it keys into a broader sense of what politics are. This idea that music can allow you to imagine worlds that you didn't think were otherwise going to be possible. And often we need to be alone and in private for that to happen.
A few other aspects of this that I think about in today's music world, particularly in the United States, and it's something that Mark Levine, you mentioned, which is oftentimes these really great music doesn't get heard, particularly in a consolidated radio world where there's not very much exploration of things that veer outside of what the establishment sees as commercial. And so I wonder if music can still play this role in the U.S. if they're A, not hearing some of this great music, but B, if they're misunderstanding some of it.
Dick Fleck, I've been really preoccupied with that question for quite a while now. Radio is no longer the framework, even though I also have my own radio show, where most people, I think younger people particularly, are getting awareness of music. You just go to YouTube and look for certain musicians, you'd be quite amazed by how many thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people have made hits on various things that you may not have heard in any other context. So I'm not sure we know all that much about how people are getting access to cultural forms, musical forms, song and performances now, but it's the opportunity for people to hear about this far transcends what radio was ever able to bring to people or what CDs are able to bring to people. And it's hard to even know what the channels of communication are among people, young people in particular, that lead them to find out about these kinds of things online and find them. But there are hundreds and hundreds of people writing songs now coming out of the Occupy movement. There just was a 4-CD album released with 99 Occupy songs. That's a lot of songs, but there's still more of them if you go to YouTube or other, just go online and look for them. I don't know what people who are producing these songs think their fate will be. It seems like people want to get their performances out there. It's cheap and technologically very feasible now to do it, so people are doing it. And whether a particular song is shared by a lot of people and known by a lot of people is one sort of question which may be hard to answer from this great Tower of Babel of music that is now out there, but certainly the creativity is happening, and I think when people are in mass protests like the Occupy types of protests, they're bound to be coming up with songs or sharing songs. And some of the major performers, Tom Morello is one of the best examples, has been going around a lot in the old Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger way to these rallies and singing and creating these songs that can be sung by people in that context.
I think that's a really great point, Mark Levine. And I think the sad part is Morello is one of the few people who's doing this on a regular basis. What's actually shocking to me in the U.S. context is how completely all these major supposedly liberal performers who, you know, will give you a benefit for Obama, you didn't see them in Wisconsin the way you'd see Morello and one or two other people. And that's something I think in America that's really sad, that how divorced even people like Springsteen and others who at one point were much more politically active have become from being out there with their music on the grassroots. They might do a big song like U2 might do a song about Iran when they had the protests after the 2009 election, but they're not doing anything that's actually putting themselves on the line.
Well, you know, I would like not to make such a sweeping generalization, because if you take Springsteen himself, not only did he put out his most political album, which is very related to the Occupy movement, but I've seen, if you go to YouTube and see some of his performances, they're very much embracing in these large mass concert venues, the movement.
Yeah.
He hasn't necessarily gone to
I certainly agree with you there, but I guess for me, coming from the Middle Eastern context, I think there's something crucial about being at the site.
Oh, I agree with that.
Creating the community there. Yes, absolutely agree. It's last, you know, very political, but I think it's very crucial for people to be with the people protesting because it brings more people down, and
yeah.
It helps create the numbers. And I'm not sure why, for the most part, most of the big name so-called liberal artists or progressive artists have not really made it a point of making Occupy their own, because had they done that, I think they would have helped sustain this movement after that initial burst inevitably was going to die down. And, you know, Morello can't be everywhere, right? And there needs to be other people. And just when you have musicians, for example, in Bahrain or in Morocco or others, when the musicians are willing to go out and sacrifice themselves either by being arrested or being on the front lines or being hosed down or even worse, beaten, this, in a way, really motivates so many other people to do the same thing. And somehow in America, we've been so far removed, even our musical elite, from being willing to do that, that it really makes it much harder for the music that we do have to have the kind of political impact that it might otherwise have, at least in my opinion.
I think that one other thing that's important to mention here, though, is, of course, if we look at the biggest civil rights marches in the history of the United States, which happened in 2006 and 2007, pro-immigration marches that gathered millions and millions and millions of people across the country, you saw bands marching. Now, these were bands that many people aren't talking about in the English-speaking world, but in the Spanish-speaking world of the United States, specifically in the context of Mexican immigration and Mexican migrancy in the United States, bands singing in Spanish, who are commercially popular bands, are at the same time on the front lines of these marches and are the musical voices of migrant Mexican America. And I think that it's really, really important when we're talking about America, in quotes, that we're also talking about and thinking about multilingual music here, and especially not leaving out the central role that Spanish language music is playing in the United States right now in shaping all kinds of debates around immigration and migrancy and all these other questions.
Well, gentlemen, I think that's a perfect place to leave it. And let me thank you all so much for this wonderful discussion. Josh Kuhn is professor of communication and journalism and also the director of the Popular Music Project at USC Annenberg's Norman Lear Center. Mark Levine is with us. He is professor of Middle Eastern history at University of California, Irvine. Richard Flax is emeritus professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at @armudian.
This land is your land. This land is my land. Land was made for you and me. As I was walking, I saw a sign there.